It went straight down the middle. Then it started to...
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce Devlin, we have this morning a major champion from Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
That's right. This lady started off on the road in an RV, was the champion in 1994 Demoria Classic, and it is indeed a pleasure to have with us this morning Martha Nowsey. Martha, thanks for joining us. We look forward to you telling your story about your love of the game.
Well, I'm excited to be here, and thanks to you guys for doing this. It's awesome.
Martha, welcome, and I'm anxious to talk because I spent a little bit of time just down the road in Milwaukee and had a chance to play a little bit of golf up in your old neck of the woods, including the course where you grew up on. As you know, we're here to tell your story, and we always start at the beginning. So tell us a little bit about growing up in Sheboygan.
Well, my family is a large family. I have four siblings. My mom and dad were avid golfers. Their first date was playing golf. And also a lot of competitiveness in their background. My mom played her first golf tournament in a little nine-hole course outside of Madison, Wisconsin. I have the trophy, and I think it was in 1948 or something like that. So it was... sort of destined to be that we were all going to have golf clubs in our hands at some point. I'm the third of five children. So my older sister and brother and I were really out on the golf course right from the get-go with my mom and dad. And I mean, evenings, my dad was a physician. So in the evenings after dinner, oftentimes we would go out to the country club and they would want to play nine holes. So they would tell a story. I don't remember this specifically, but my mom and dad would tell a story how they'd get a cart. They'd set my older sister, Julie, and my brother, Peter, and I out on the first tee. They'd take off and say, "We'll pick you up when we're done with nine holes." And off we would go. And we would generally not quite to the second green by the time they got finished with nine holes.
Oh, boy.
But they, you know, they let us make our way around whatever we could do on the golf course, which was a very, very tough golf course, super hilly. The greens were some of the hardest greens I've ever played, in save for Oakmont, maybe.
Yeah.
Oakmont's a little more challenging. But, you know, we just got to play a lot of golf. My mom played some tournaments in the state of Wisconsin, and she also was instrumental in helping to develop a good junior program at Pine Hills Country Club, along with the head pro, Ken Seasons. And so we would have Friday morning, we'd have junior lessons every Friday of the summer. And then they had little tournaments for us, starting with three-holers and then nine-holers. And, you know, we would have like a little club tournament at the end of the summer. I mean, there were just a lot of opportunities for us to play, given that we couldn't get on the golf course all the time because, you know, all the restrictions for having juniors on the course were pretty stringent. But the pro knew that we were going to pay attention and were disciplined enough to not be troublemakers. So we would hang out in the pro shop, my brother and my sister and I and other kids. And then eventually he'd say, "You kids, just go off and, you know, go off the back nine. And when some grown-ups show up, you get off to the side and you get out of the way. But go and have a good time." So that was kind of my introduction to the, you know, the game that was so fun. We just got to play and... we didn't hit balls on the range because we didn't have a range pass, but we spent a lot of time on the little putting green that we were allowed to be on. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
You know, it's unfortunate because a lot of clubs, probably more nowadays, they just don't provide access to the kids like it seems like you used to when we grew up. Because Martha and I, you know, we're sort of the same vintage. And I can remember as a kid back in the 60s at our little nine-hole place. And they were really pretty good about it, surprisingly.
Yeah. I mean, we just sort of, it was sort of our, you know, being at the golf club was sort of our summer playground. And mostly because my mom played tournaments and she wanted to get out there and play and practice. And, you know, so, I mean, a lot of times my brother and I would just spend time rummaging around in the river and the woods looking for golf balls, you know, and staying out of the way as much as possible. But my mom played some tournaments around the state, and she, when I was 10, I guess she said to my dad, I want to go play this tournament. And it's going to be a 3-day, you know, I'll be away for 3 days. And he said, that's fine. Take the girls with you and, you know, let's get them playing. So off we went. And so at age 10, I did my first overnight tournament, away from home, and I lost badly, but I had fun, you know. And, you know, the thing was, I had such a great role model with my mom. She was a fierce competitor. And I watched, you know, when I'd be finished with my golf for the day, I'd go out and watch her play. And she won the tournament. It was a fairly big one within the state of Wisconsin, the Northeastern Golf Association tournament. And she either, if she won or she lost, I was always so impressed with her demeanor. And she was a fabulous winner. You know, she, on one event, she was playing a gal who was such a big hitter, and my mom couldn't keep up with her off the tee, but this gal was also a little wild. So she'd get in the woods, and the match was tied on the going into the 18th hole, and her competitor hit it in the trees. My mom was right down the middle and on the green. And then, you know, we're all thinking, oh, she's got this one won. Well, the gal hits a sort of a Laura Davies type. She hits a shot out of the trees that you just can never believe and onto the green herself. And a little farther away from the hole than my mom, she putts first. She makes about a 35 footer. And or I guess my mom was one up. My head had been one up. And she makes a 35-footer. Now the crowd was more for this other gal. Crowd was going wild, and my mom steps up, and she drains her 30-footer to win the tournament. And, you know, she was an amazing competitor. But one of the best lessons I ever learned from her was watching her lose. Because she, you know, a lot of other ladies I'd see lose, they'd, you know, get a little irritated and stomp off the green and barely congratulate their competitor. But my mom was the first one to go over and give the person a big hug and congratulate her. And, you know, it just made a big impact on me.
Yeah. And what great life lessons that I think we probably all learned as youngsters around the game of golf.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, growing up, I realized late in my career what a huge impact golf had on forming me as a person. I was sort of at a stage in my career where I wasn't playing well and I was frustrated. And, you know, I wasn't feeling good about the game at all. And I was, you know, reading some books about the Zen of golf or whatever. And it asked me a question of, you know, what has this game done for you? And I had to sit down and think, wow, you know, between all the lessons I learned as a child growing up, the discipline and, you know, the competitiveness, and then all the lessons that I learned and how golf changed me as a person. I was super shy coming out of high school and college. And I all of a sudden I'm on the tour having to relate to and talk to a lot of people I didn't know. And going to places I'd never been. And, you know, it was such a huge impact for me that golf was such a big part of forming me as a person. So I wasn't feeling so bad about the game anymore.
So Martha, you mentioned Ken, the pro there at Pine Hills Country Club. Yeah. Well, did he, was he the guy that actually taught you? I know you were around your mom and dad a lot, but what influence did he have on your game?
Well, he taught us a very simple swing. There was nothing mechanical about it. He'd line us all up on the range all together, and we'd all hit a ball together, and he'd say, you know, ready, one, two, three, swing through the ball. And, yeah. You know, one was we put our right knee in a little bit, two was our backswing, and three, we'd swing through the ball. And that was really it. And, you know, he would have, he just had a good positive influence. Again, nothing technical that I remember. We would have chipping lessons and all that sort of stuff. But really the person that ultimately formed me as a professional golfer was Manuel De La Torre.
Right.
And after I graduated from college and decided I wanted to try to get on the tour, he was in Milwaukee and I was in Sheboygan, so only 45 minutes away. And we contacted him and he said, yes, I can give lessons to non-members after I'm finished with my usual day, so after 6 p.m. And he said, so that was the summer of 77. And he said, I have 2 half-hour lessons available for the summer. And this was in June.
Wow,
and
yeah.
By that time, he was pretty well booked. So we signed up. I signed up for them. My mom and dad, you know, said they'd help me go through the process. So they helped me get signed up and all. And I went and had my first lessons with Manuel, and I never looked back. I mean, his teaching really, again, non-technical and all, you know, as natural as possible, and made sense to me. And I ended up working with him for 42 years, including the year just before he passed at age 94. And he was just a huge, huge part of my whole development as a golfer.
Yeah, swinging to the target.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he worked with a few other named golfers, didn't he?
Well, Carol Mann was
Hall of
probably
Famer.
The most famous, and she was working with him at the time, or had just been working with him when I was, you know, trying to find somebody to go see. I decided at when I was graduating from college that I wanted to try to get on the tour. Did not have those aspirations growing up. But anyway, Carol Mann, and then he also worked with a number of other LPGA players at the time, but then also Sherry Steinhauer from Wisconsin,
right.
Also in a more contemporary name. But she and I were his main students while we were both on the tour.
Yeah, yeah. I know later in his career, and we visited with Tommy Aaron about this, but Tommy remembers, took us back to when he first encountered Manuel. I want to say, Bruce, he had probably just was starting the senior tour when he worked with Manuel.
That's right. That's correct. Yeah. Well, Manuel is, he's had a great reputation in the game for helping people. There's no doubt about it. Very significant man.
Yeah. He, you know, and not only did he help me with my own golf swing, but you know, after I retired from playing full time, I started coaching, and I coached at men and women at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. And then I was, you know, this was not a big, program where people had their own pros and their teachers and all this stuff. So I was the teacher, and I started going and Manuel helped me learn how to teach the golf swing. And I mean, honestly, I've used that method of swing the club to, you know, in the direction of the target, with everybody from beginners to low handicap men, and help them. And, it's just to me such a simple way to swing the golf club, which is a complicated movement.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to your high school days. And again, kind of putting the dates together, I would guess you probably started high school in about 1968. This was pre-Title IX, and so life was different for young girls trying to compete athletically. And you get to high school at Sheboygan North, and there is no women's golf team.
That's right. As a matter of fact, we only had swimming for sports. We had swimming, and my senior year, we had basketball. And track. But no girls' golf team. And the summer before my senior year, I won the Wisconsin State Junior Championship. And I had won other tournaments prior to that that were pretty big tournaments in the state of Wisconsin. So there are a lot of people in my high school, guys that were on the golf team that I had grown up playing golf with, and they knew of my ability. And some of them said, well, you should join the boys' golf team because, you know, you could help us. And I was super shy in high school and was not any sort of, I don't want to create any waves here. And I thought, well, you know, at least I could play. That would be fun. But then I got wind that the rest of the team said that if I made the team, they'd all quit. And so I decided I didn't want to be that rabble rouser and I'd go do something else. So I did not play high school golf. And when I went to college, I really wasn't looking to play. Like I said, I had no aspirations to get on the tour. So I ended up going to a school that also didn't have golf for women until my senior year. So it really, you know, golf for me was really a family summer endeavor. Mm-hmm. In Wisconsin, we got to play June, July, and August.
Yeah, that's about
school it. School got out, and then school started, and we put the clubs away, and we did other things. So, yeah.
Well, you did some other things, too, from what I understand. You played the French horn, and you become a Girl Scout, and you studied whales off Alaska. You've been a busy lady, haven't you?
Well, you know, my whole life has been about doing a lot of different things. And yeah, I started playing musical instruments when I was about the same age as I started playing golf. But, you know, I played the piano and guitar and French horn. I went to Alaska and, well, the funny thing about going to Alaska is it was in my summer before my senior year in college. I was a biology major. And I could get some college credit for this National Outdoor Leadership Program in Alaska. So I went up there and spent this whole summer in Alaska, partly because I was bored with golf and I didn't want to just be in Sheboygan doing the same old thing anymore. So I actually took almost the entire summer off from playing golf before my senior year of college. And I mean, I loved it. It was so fascinating. I love nature. Have my cottage here, so the whales. We were kayaking amongst the whales, and that was pretty incredible. We climbed up a glacier and all sorts of stuff. Girl Scouts. I did that my entire life. My mom was the leader. I kind of had to do it.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, one of the things I thought about when I was trying to decide whether I wanted to go on the tour is how can I give up all these other things that I enjoy doing? I loved skiing, snow skiing, and I played racquetball, and I played in high school or college, I played basketball and volleyball, and I'm just an average sports person. And I thought, how could I give up all this stuff to just play golf? So I've been busy.
Yeah. Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, one in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Well, at least you picked the sport that you can still play at our age.
Yeah.
Well, right. I mean, I couldn't play tennis. My family, we were golfers. So, you know, when I was growing up, pre-Title IX, as you said, the only sports really that were okay for girls to play were golf and tennis. And, you know, tennis wasn't in the cards for me. And so I was like, well, I'll give golf a try. And I don't know what else I really want to do, so I'm going to give golf a try and see what happens.
Yeah. So take us through this process you went through where, you know, you get to high school. There's no girls team, as you say. And then you get to college and there's no women's team as you start out at St. Olaf. And all of a sudden, at some point, you graduate and you're thinking about turning professional golfer. So help us from getting from A to B.
Yeah. It's a crazy story, really. You know, I played golf all my life in the summertime, and I was very competitive and I was successful, and I was playing against girls that were getting some of the few scholarships that were available, and I was beating them, or I was at least holding my own with them. When I was going to college, you know, women's golf in the early 70s was pretty minimal. And I mean, barely had anything on TV. You never read anything about it in the paper. So I really didn't have the role models that, you know, showed me that this was something possible. And, you know, I actually talked with my mom and dad when I was getting ready, you know, trying to figure out what to do going to college. And people would say to me, well, you could maybe get a scholarship for golf. And I'm like, well, what am I ever going to do with that? Because I want to get an education because I'm going to need that. You know, I'm not going to be able to make money at playing golf. You know, these ladies, the biggest winners out there are barely making a living. Yeah. So I went to St. Olaf College and did not have a golf team. I wasn't interested in pursuing golf that avidly. I liked the game, but it was just one of the things that I did. So I got my degree in biology. I played my French horn there. I played other sports. I actually wanted to go to the University of Wisconsin. Being a Wisconsin person, that's sure. What you do.
Yeah, you go to
and
Madison.
My mom and dad, yeah, my mom and dad were Wisconsin alum. And but Wisconsin was going to be too big a school for me. And my mom and dad knew that. They sort of pushed me towards a smaller school. And they said, you know, if you go to a bigger school, you're not going to be able to do a lot of the things that you want to do outside of studying. So I ended up going to St. Olaf, and it was a fabulous place for me. Met a lot of great people that are still friends of mine, but played all these other sports. Then my senior year in college, you know, you got to start thinking about what you're going to do next, right?
Yeah.
And I had just spent the summer in Alaska studying whales. Then I thought, you know, I want to be a marine biologist. I want to study whales, but it was too late for me to get into graduate programs for the year after I graduated. So my senior second semester, I had very few classes that I had to take because of my summer program that I had gotten credits for. So I was taking a tennis class and I was working out in the mornings, and then I would do some other things. And then we had a women's golf program. So then I would go practice golf on my own. And I was doing so many athletic things. I thought, wouldn't it be cool to be a professional athlete where, you know, they would just pay you to play? And So that was the first little thing in my head. Then I would go, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I went to the Career Counseling Center at St. Olaf, and there were just stacks of pamphlets of different kinds of careers. And I was paging through them, and, you know, all of a sudden there was a pamphlet on the PGA Tour. No LPGA, but the PGA. And I read it, not thinking I would do PGA, but I was like, maybe I could try the LPGA. I don't know. I was playing against girls that had scholarships, and they were, and I was holding my own against them. And they were playing against people that were getting on tour and making it on the tour. So I kind of thought, well, if A equals B and B equals C, I wonder if A equals C. And so, I mean, literally what happened was I went back to my dorm. I saw a friend. She said, what you been doing today? And I said, I'm pretending to be a professional golfer. And I thought she'd laugh and that would be the end of it. We'd have a big laugh and yeah, on we'd go. She said, well, don't pretend, do it. And yeah, I was like, oh, yeah, right. Here's Martha Nowsey. She's on the 18th green of the U.S. Open. She has to make this putt. And I went through the whole thing, and I thought she'd just laugh. She said, if you have a chance, why not try? And I was like, I don't know. So then I, you know, went to a couple other friends, and I said, what if I was going to try to be a professional golfer? And they were like, why not? Why not give it a try?
Yeah.
So I called my mom and dad, and they had been pressuring me. What are you going to do? What are you going to do with, you know, after you graduate? And this had been going on for quite a few months. So I said, I think I know what I want to try to do. And they were like, yeah, what's that? And I said, I want to try to get on the tour. And they said, awesome, let's do it.
Yeah.
And again,
great.
Again, if they had said, that's crazy, you're nuts, you know, I don't know what you're thinking about, I probably wouldn't have pursued it. But they were so enthusiastic. And my mom said, we'll help. And that's how it all started for me.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine what would have happened had that college roommate and your parents and friends reacted differently.
Well, I've gained a lot of confidence in my years since then, but back then I needed a lot of boosting up. And you know, I was somebody that appreciated the boost, the push a little bit, and the support. And, you know, I've thought of it so many times. I don't know what I would have done had their reactions been negative. I would not have tried it out, I don't think. I wouldn't have given it a try. So,
yeah. Well, that's interesting. So, other than just raising your hand and saying, okay, I'm now a golf professional, which was kind of that probably not exaggerating the process for some back in the early days, right, Bruce? I mean, you kind of
That's
declare,
right.
You know, but what was that process for you, Martha?
Well, the LPGA had just started where you had to go through an LPGA qualifying school. And it's very different then than it is now, where they have multiple levels and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people that are trying in the first level. I basically signed up to go to the qualifying school. I had to have a handicap of, I think, 2 or less. I'm not sure exactly. But I really just had to sign up and show up at this qualifying school, which was just a 4-day tournament. But going back, so when I graduated from college, I went back to Sheboygan and then got to see Manuel. And I always loved this whole process with Manuel, because he said, when I showed up, he said, now, what is it you're trying to do? Well, I didn't realize at the time he meant with my golf swing, but I said to him, oh, I want to get on the tour. And he's like, oh, okay. And so then we started working on my golf swing and all that. Well, fast forward, I'll fill in the blanks later, but fast forward to after I qualified, I called Manuel and I said, Manuel, I made it. He said, you made what? And I said, I made the tour. I qualified. And he said to me, oh, I thought maybe you were going to work on your game for a couple years and then try it. I said, no, I'm on the tour now. I don't know what to do, but I'm on the tour now. So anyway, he was amazing. Anyway, so go back. And I went to Manuel and I played and practiced that summer of 77. And I just played in every tournament I could get into. And played in my first national level tournament that summer. And I did okay. It was a match play thing. And I did okay. I won a match here and there, but I never won anything. And then the qualifying school was the end of January in 78. And I went and I showed up in my shabby old clothes and with my little carry bag that had a rip on the side. And there were 68 people there that were trying to get 13 spots on the tour. And some of them were some Japanese ladies that had come over that had been playing on the JLPGA. Some of them were college players that were, Nancy Lopez had just gotten on the tour. So they were like the next Nancy Lopez with their fancy bags and their agents and their fancy clothes and, this, that, and the other thing. And here I was, I had no idea what I was doing. And I happened to be paired with the top ranked player for my first two rounds. And I think I was, I don't know. I'm never good at my scores. I was close to par, if not maybe a little under after the first nine. And she and I are walking down the 10th fairway and she looked at me and she said, where did you come from? Because I had never been, I didn't play in college and I hadn't been on the national amateur circuit or anything like that. And I was like, oh, I'm from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And long story short, I qualified and she didn't.
Oh my.
So all of a sudden I finished this tournament and they said, here you go, pass the rules test and now you can play on the tour. And it was like, wow, okay. I think that summer before that, there was a tournament in Minneapolis and I called up a friend and I said, you want to go to this tournament with me? I think I'm going to try to get on this tour. I should probably see what it's all about. So I went and spectated for a day. And that was my only experience with knowing what the LPGA was all about. But I have a funny story about that. We're, all the people are all over the place. I'd never been playing golf around that many people. I wasn't playing, but I was imagining. And on the first tee, teeing off and the crowds are around the first tee. And I happened to see Betty Burfeind hit her tee shot. And at the time, she was one of the longest hitters on the tour. And I watched it and I was like, I can't do that. Oh boy. But then followed around, and then I was watching another hole. Donna Capone was one of the best players at the time. And she came up on the green, and she had a, 4 or 5 foot putt. And she stalked it, and she looked at it from every which way. And everybody was quiet. And she got up, and she missed the putt. And I turned to my friend, I said, I can do that. I can miss that putt too. And I said, I think I can do this. So I was totally naive. I had no idea what I was up against, but I did it. I made it. And I never lost my card.
Yeah. Well, as Bruce will attest, it's one thing to get on the tour, but it's pretty tough to win on the tour, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it took me 10 years to win a tournament. Though my first tournament, I was on the leaderboard the first day. I was like, wow, look at that. My name's on the leaderboard. If I keep playing like this, I might have to play with Judy Rankin. She was one of the few names that I knew because she had been the first $100,000 career season winner. I missed the cut, but at any rate, 10 years. And I had come close a few times. I missed a putt that would have put me in a playoff in Hershey, Pennsylvania. It did get me into the Dinosaur, so that was a big thing for me. But, you know, I just wanted to try to keep playing. Once I was out there for a little while, I knew I had the physical skills, but I just didn't know whether mentally I had it. I was very hard on myself, and if I saw my name on the leaderboard, I would sort of self-sabotage and, you know, oh, I get all nervous and I get distracted and then I would goof up. And so I ended up going to Bob Rotella, a sports psychologist. He was one of the first sports psychologists. And he helped me a lot. He helped me realize, you know, how to think better about competing. And I can't remember what year that was that I saw him, but finally I broke through on my 10th year on the tour and won my first tournament, the Planner's Pat Bradley, which was a Stableford tournament. Mm-hmm. And it sort of helped me that it was a Stableford tournament because it was a different way of playing, a different way of thinking. You had to be more aggressive and go for the pin and, you know, go for the putts and try to get those points with the birdies and eagles, if you could make an eagle. That was a huge breakthrough for me. Just knowing that I won a tournament was huge. And then a couple more followed later, but I mean, that it was hard. It was hard to win. And, you know, you always compare yourself with the people that are winning all the time, right? And you're like, why can't I do that? And I know I used to go to the leaderboard when I was early in my career to try to get some confidence. I would try to find one of the superstars that was playing well. And if I only could beat them for 9 holes, I'd say, well, look at this. I could do that. I beat them on that 9 holes, so I should be able to keep it going. But it's such a hard game mentally.
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah, you know, you touch on that, Martha, and I'll ask Bruce too, but both of you. Aside from the development in equipment since the time that you both played, a couple of other developments, I think, agronomics certainly, but the mental aspects of the game and also physical conditioning. What do you think has been the most significant advance beyond equipment in the game? Is it the mental side? Because, you know, we talked to people that played in your era, Martha, and as I like to relate, Lanny Watkins telling us, he said, you know, all these young whippersnappers, they've got their teams with them. He said, my team was me, my caddy, and whoever the bartender was in the town I was playing in.
Well, I mean, that's really so true. I've gone out to watch some tournaments, some players and some tournaments in the last few years, and they do have a team. And you have to have support. Otherwise, you know, you're left alone with your thoughts, and if you aren't disciplined in what you're thinking, you can go down the wrong road, you know, way down the wrong road. You know, if you just mishit a shot a little bit, that can start a spiral that can get ugly. And I would say the mental side of things has been the biggest difference, because everybody has the access to the equipment. Certainly the physical fitness side of things has changed the game in terms of maybe being able to swing a little faster or whatever, but it's we're all so different mentally, and we all have our strengths and our weaknesses in how we think. And the people that can harness their thoughts, I think, makes the biggest difference. I mean, you think about a golf swing taking 2.5 seconds. And if you shoot, I'm not going to do the math for you, but if you shoot 70, how many seconds are you actually performing your sport?
Yeah,
not very long.
Yeah, only a few minutes, you know, maybe a minute or so. So the rest of the time is just your head and, you know, what are you thinking? How are you preparing for it? I mean, there's a lot of that. But in between shots, how you react, how you let it go, how you don't let bad shots go, how you get ahead of yourself, that there's so many mental aspects to the game that can be detrimental.
Yeah.
Or if you think the right way, they can be, you know, beneficial.
Yeah. Bruce, are there some fellas that you played with that come to mind that had they had access to today's mental approach, coaching, tools, et cetera, could have gotten out of their way and won a lot more?
You know, I'm not sure. That brings back a memory of a gentleman that I thought, you know, I wouldn't even stand on the practice tee with him. He was so intimidating, a young man by the name of Paul Bonderson, who I ended up giving a job later in his career. But I think a young man like that could have done with that help from a group of guys or gals or whatever. But I think Martha's right. I think it's definitely the mental side of it. But you know, today's sports people are much more physically active than what we were when we were growing up. I mean, you know, like Lanny said, you know, our exercise was, you know, picking up a glass of beer.
You weren't in the workout trailer every morning, huh?
No, not
what
likely.
Workout trailer?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. Martha, you remember making your first check?
Yes, I do. And I have a picture of it. I was so excited. I took a picture of it. $212.68 or something like that. I played, you know, on my rookie year, I played about 6 months before I made a check. And we had the size of the fields at that time were pretty small. I mean, really small compared to what they are now. And sometimes when we had our biggest purses, we would get fields of 70 or more, but the payments were for the top 60 and ties. And there were oftentimes, well, sometimes I made the cut. If we had a cut, I'd be, you know, from 60 to 70, and I never made a check. So I made my first check in, well, I don't remember exactly where, maybe Baltimore, mm-hmm. $212. And I thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread that I made money playing golf.
Yeah. Mm.
But yeah, so it was funny that first year, in order to keep my card for the next year, at that time, you had to... There was a money threshold that you had to earn, and it was, I don't know, a percentage of the total purses of the entire season. And I had to make $1,800 my first year to keep my card for the next year. And I had made $1,600 with four tournaments to go. And this was a schedule of about 30 tournaments. So boy. I wasn't doing real well. My chances were looking a little bleak, but I went out and we were in Oakland, California, and I ended up leading the tournament after the first day. I shot a 68, which I'd never been under par before, much less that much under par. And I was leading the tournament and I was like, wow. Look at this. And I saw Kathy Whitworth in the locker room. And She said, congratulations on your great round. Now, tomorrow, just go out there and have fun. And well, I shot 80-something, but I made the cut. I made the cut. And I ended up making the $500 that I needed to cross the threshold for my $1,800 goal.
Right, yeah.
And then I went crazy and I made a couple hundred dollars in the last three tournaments. Every tournament I made some money after that.
Yeah,
and I ended up making $2,200 or so for the first year. And thankfully my parents were helping me get through it all. But you remember those things. You remember making your first check.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to that first win, which was the 1988 Planters Pat Bradley International at the time. That was at Willow Creek Country Club in North Carolina. And you mentioned a different format, stablefoot format. So it was by 1 point over Debbie Massey and Judy Dickinson. You did mention that perhaps it was the different format that helped you break through. I was wondering whether that might be the case, because it had to be it is a just different mental approach with stablefoot, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I mean, honestly, I almost didn't even get through the first round that week. I mean, they changed it every once in a while. I don't know, they changed the format a little bit, but that year, there was a cut of half the field after each round. And I was on the cut line after the first day. I had to do a playoff to get through to the second round.
Oh, my.
Mm.
So I got through that playoff, and then the next day I was a little better. And each day the points started over. So the next day I was a little better, and I was close to the cut line, but I made the cut. The third day, I don't remember. I mean, I got in pretty easily, but it was a different, in my mind, it was a different attitude because, you know, what do they say? If you made a double eagle, you'd get 8 points or something like that. And I kept saying to my caddy, I'm going for the 8-pointer. I'm going for the 8-pointer. But it just made me much more focused on trying to get it as close as possible and making a birdie, where I didn't have quite that same focus in other tournaments. I was very conservative. I didn't want to make mistakes. You know, other tournaments, that was sort of my probably helped me play for 22 years and not lose my card, but it also may have prevented me from maybe winning a couple more times. I don't know. But at any rate, it just was a different feel for me.
Did your approach change then after that tournament that, hey, maybe I need to be a little bit more aggressive or not?
You know, I thought that was probably a good idea, but I just easily slipped back a little more into doing what I had been doing. So it seems like, you'd think, oh, yeah, now this is the way I'm going to play from now on. But I didn't necessarily. Yeah. I did. But that was sort of during the time when I was really delving deeply into more sports psychology stuff. And I worked with different sports psychologists and read a lot of books, you know, Pia Nielsen and Lynn Marriott, and their Vision 54 was still just barely coming out. But there were a lot of other people that I worked with through the years. And you know, like I said, did a lot of reading of different books, Fred Shoemaker books and things like that, where I just learned a little bit at a time. And one of the things that really made a difference for me was, you know, changing the questions that I was asking myself. I used to see my name on a leaderboard, and I would then get distracted, and I would always say to myself, why do I always screw up? Why do I always self-sabotage? And I read something that said, ask yourself the questions of what you want, not what you don't want. And I started asking myself the question, what do I need to do to win? What do I need to do to be a champion? And it changed my outlook on practicing. People came into my life that helped me learn more things. It opened my mind to being more on the positive side of things. And, you know, that made a big difference in helping me then win again. And I did realize though, never look at the leaderboard. That doesn't do me any good.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge offline. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle. Quiet.